It's not easy to say no when you see and you know and you look at the eyes of the people that have been through these tragic situations.
King Cove residents make the case for a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, September 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a low harvest walrus harvest prompts a disaster declaration.
We're talking about walrus, which is a significant portion of the economy and the diet subsistence harvest of folks on St. Lawrence Island.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell has a difficult decision ahead of her. She was in King Cove Friday to visit with residents about a road they want to build through the heart of Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Residents say the road is necessary to access emergency medical treatment, but a road has never been built through a wilderness area, and environmental groups say it would set a bad precedent. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
When an emergency call wakes up Benita Babcock in the middle of the night, one of the first things she does is check the weather.
How bad is it blowing?
Babcock is a lifelong resident of King Cove and a community health aide. It's her job to help stabilize patients with traumatic injuries, heart attacks, or other emergencies, and get them ready to fly to the nearest hospital in Anchorage, 600 miles away.
We're looking and it's like, okay, most of the time it's going to have to be a medevac, and we're wondering, what are we looking at here? What are we looking at? Are they going to be able to get them out?
About 30% of the time, the answer is no. High winds frequently shut down King Cove's small gravel airstrip. Cold Bay, 30 miles away, has an all-weather airport. But with no road between the communities, King Cove residents have to take a two-hour boat ride in choppy seas to reach Cold Bay when flying isn't an option. King Cove has been asking for a road for more than two decades, but Friday was their first chance to make their case directly to an Interior Secretary.
Secretary Benita, she's one of our
How do you do, Benita?
She'll be giving us a tour of the clinic.
Excellent.
Follow Benita.
Okay.
Babcock toured Secretary Sally Jewell around the King Cove Clinic. Jewell heard stories of medical close calls, like a baby who couldn't breathe and had to be rescued by a Coast Guard helicopter. And she heard about the daily hardship of unreliable transportation out of or into the community. Babcock told Jewell the clinic sometimes has to make do without essential medication.
Last week, 6 days it sat in Cold Bay, one of our patients' meds, you know, and...
And there's no boats running back and forth?
You can't handle
well,
it.
The postmaster would have to go over by boat.
I see.
And she will, yeah.
But the 11-mile, one-lane gravel road that could make life safer in King Cove would also slice through the center of Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. Environmental groups say that would set a precedent that could make it easier to build roads through other wilderness areas. Nicole Whittington-Evans with the Wilderness Society says it's an important sanctuary for bird species like the black brant and the tundra swan.
When you are in Eisenbeck and you look around at the breathtaking coastal mountains and this incredibly vibrant and ecologically rich area, you know it is a global resource that we should be protecting.
Whittington Evans says the road would take more than 2 hours to drive, and she's skeptical it would be the fastest way to evacuate people with medical emergencies. King Cove residents acknowledge the road isn't just about health and safety. It would make it cheaper to fly to Anchorage, for instance, and high school sports teams could more reliably compete against other villages. Secretary Jewell says it's a tough problem. She wants to find a solution that works both for the wildlife and for the people of King Cove.
I think that there have been efforts to talk about a trade-off between human safety and wildlife, and the reality is I think we want both. And so, you know, I understand the interests on both sides. It's difficult, and I don't think that that's a a reasonable trade-off.
Jewell hasn't set a timeline for making a decision. If she comes out in favor of the road, she'll be going against the recommendation of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But Etta Kazakin, who's president of the Ogdow Tribal Council in King Cove, is hopeful that's what she'll do.
It's easy to say no when you see it in writing on paper. But it's not easy to say no when you see and you know and you look at the eyes of the people that have been through these tragic situations.
5 months ago, Kazakin went into premature labor in King Cove when the winds were howling. She made it out of the community later that day on a Coast Guard helicopter. She has a healthy daughter now named Sunny Ray, but she worries about future emergencies that may not have a similarly happy ending. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Governor Sean Parnell declared an economic disaster for residents on St. Lawrence Island Thursday. An unusually low walrus harvest is currently impacting the more than 1,300 residents that make the island home. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Walrus hunting occurs in the springtime on St. Lawrence Island. Residents in Gamble and Savunga typically harvest 1,000 walruses during the animal's annual migration from the Bering to the Chukchi Sea. This spring, because of unusual southwest winds and poor weather conditions, a long, solid strip of ice kept hunters from reaching the animal's migration route and their usual hunting waters. 340 walruses were harvested, just 36% of the average annual harvest, and the lowest harvest on record. Glenn Haight works in the Division of Economic Development within the Department of Commerce. His office recommended that the governor issue an economic disaster declaration after looking at the economics of the walrus harvest on St. Lawrence Island. Haight says the department realizes the subsistence lifestyle goes way beyond any monetary value, but for their report, they did strictly look at the monetary value of an average walrus harvest.
What's, I think, more outstanding about this particular issue is we're talking about walrus, which is a significant portion of the economy and the diet subsistence harvest of folks on St. Lawrence Island.
80 to 90% of our diet comes from marine mammals.
Vera Metcalf in Nome is the director of the Eskimo Walrus Commission. She herself grew up in Savunga and has been working with the communities of Gamble and Savunga since April. More recently, she's provided data on harvest to Glenn Haight's office at the Department of Commerce. And according to the Department of Commerce's report to the governor, the subsistence lifestyle is worth roughly $17,000 in some homes on the island.
It's a conservative viewpoint of what the value of subsistence is. I think it's a minimal look at it.
And so a conservative look at it would mean that the subsistence lifestyle in Gamble brings in about $2.8 million annually. And while most residents on the island would not consider themselves poverty-stricken, the estimated household income at $35,000 to $38,000 places them below the federal poverty guideline, with the economics of the subsistence lifestyle taken into account. Without subsistence foods, the average income per household in Gamble is at $22,000. The declaration of economic disaster does not mean money will be funneled to the communities of Savunga and Gamble. The legislature may appropriate money for assistance grants. The governor may also recommend that capital projects planned for the island be put on the fast track. Department of Commerce Commissioner Susan Bell has compiled information for aid programs for St. Lawrence Island residents. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kanin.
The field for governor just got more crowded. Byron Mallott says he plans to take on Sean Parnell as a Democrat. Mallott is a familiar face in Alaska politics. He served as mayor of both Juneau and Yakutat. He was the first commissioner of the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. He's headed the Sea Alaska Corporation and directed the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. While Mallott still hasn't filed the paperwork needed to run, he declared his candidacy yesterday in an interview with the Alaska Dispatch. There had been some some speculation that he might follow Bill Walker's lead and run as an independent. Instead, Mallott wants to earn the Democratic nomination. That means he could face off against State Senator Hollis French in a party primary. French hasn't officially committed to entering the race, but he's announced he's exploring a run and he's registered with the state as a candidate. French says Mallott's announcement shouldn't affect his final decision on the issue.
I've never been one to try to, you know, arm twist other candidates into getting in or out of the race. I think this is a good development.
Mallott could not be reached for comment for this story. Alaska and 21 other states are supporting the National Rifle Association in a lawsuit against the federal government. The case, which is before the Supreme Court, will decide whether a federal ban on selling handguns to anyone under the age of 21 is constitutional. While Alaska Attorney General Michael Garrity signed on to the amicus brief, the effort was led by Alabama. The filing argues the law discriminates against 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, who states would otherwise allow to buy handguns. Previously, a federal judge in Texas and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals sided with the federal government, upholding the ban. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rapper, a CEO, and an NBA star visit a community in rural Alaska.
I think the whole school is just totally excited. I mean, stuff like this doesn't happen here that often.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by Enroll Alaska, helping educate and enroll Alaskans in health insurance under the federal mandate created by the Affordable Care Act. Learn more at enrollingalaska.com.
The Alaska Arctic Policy Commission has a big mandate to figure out what kind of Arctic policy the state should have. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, they inched toward that goal during a meeting in Unalaska last week.
By the end of January, the commission is supposed to come up with a set of recommendations for the Alaska legislature to help them write an Arctic policy for the state. The group of lawmakers, conservationists, and small-town mayors on the Alaska Arctic Policy Commission, or AAPC, made progress on those recommendations in Unalaska. But they also spent a fair amount of time talking about another set of policy goals and priorities, the federal government's. Bob Heron is Unalaska's state representative and the co-chair of the AAPC.
We just want a reassurance that there will be a coordination.
Just like Alaska, the federal government's Arctic policy doesn't exist yet. They've come out with a broad strategy plan for Arctic development, but they're still trying to figure out how to implement it. Heron and other AAPC members spent an afternoon grilling Brendan Kelly, a White House polar policy representative, on whether the federal process can line up with the state's. Heron wanted to know if the federal government can hold off on publishing anything else about Arctic policy until the AAPC has finished up their work for the state legislature. Kelly said that might be possible, but not everything on the AAPC's wish list is. Commissioner Stephanie Madsen asked for a budget for the new infrastructure and research that the federal government will need in the Arctic.
Well, what are the funding sources and the money that is going to be affiliated with?
So there will be no budget specifically associated with this.
The strategy was written so it wouldn't tie up any funding. Kelly said it's going to be a while before we know the price tag for building up the federal government's presence in the Arctic. While the conversation was enough to satisfy some members of the commission, others were more skeptical. Kathy Giesel, a state senator, says she's just not convinced that the AAPC will be able to influence the federal government at this stage. That's why Giesel thinks it's more important to stay focused on the task at hand, giving the Alaska legislature a foundation for writing Arctic policy.
Don't we need to wait until the legislature has looked at it before we actually take this forward to the feds?
Kelly, the White House liaison, disagrees. He says he's taking the state's concerns back to Washington with him. And he says the meeting did set up the state and federal government to communicate better down the road.
You don't get to hold that, touch it, point to it, you know, put it on the bookshelf, but I think makes a huge difference in how well we're able to serve people as a government.
And when it comes down to it, the state and federal governments are going to have to work together to regulate and respond to development in the far north. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The Greens Creek mine on Admiralty Island might have to shut down in 2016 unless it can find more room to dispose of its spent ore. Mike Satry is the manager of government and community relations for the Hecla Mining Company. He told the Sitka Chamber of Commerce last week that Greens Creek was undertaking an extensive permitting process to increase the area where it can put the spent ore, known in the industry as tailings. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The best thing to do with mine tails, Satry said, is to put them back in the ground. And that's what Greens Creek does with a little over half of the rock it extracts. It's mixed with cement and used to fill shafts and leads and provide solid support for the miners working other parts of the ore body. But that leaves the rest on the surface, a large pile of material in a national monument in the middle of the continent's largest rainforest, a large pile of material that can't get wet. Satry described the pains Greens Creek takes to store tails.
So what we do is we dewater those tails, we truck them down to the Hawk Inlet area. We have an engineer facility where we cleared and grubbed everything off. We put down geotextile lining. We've isolated any water from coming into that area. And we place those tails in a very engineered fashion and then protect them from oxygen and air infiltration and ultimately plan for closure.
Water and oxygen plus mine tailings produces an acid, Satry said. Greens Creek collects runoff from the tailings area and sends it to its own water treatment plant. The trucks that deliver tailings are rinsed in a giant car wash.
We've gone through one EIS, one expansion that allowed us to come out this way to the east and a little bit higher than originally planned and permitted. Now we need even more room, so we want to come further to the south. We've gone through an EIS process that, of course, has multiple alternatives that are out there. There is a no-action alternative, just like anything in a NEPA process. If we don't get a permit to expand our tails facility, probably by 2016, the mine will be forced to shut down and go into reclamation and closure. We simply won't have a place to put our tails.
Satry made the case before the Sitka Chamber that closure was not an attractive alternative. Greens Creek is on Admiralty Island, about 18 miles south of Juneau, and is one of the leading silver mines in the world, producing 2,200 tons a day of a fine sand concentrate containing silver, zinc, gold, or lead. The mine employs 390 people directly and has a payroll of $54 million. The Greens Creek ore deposit was discovered in 1975, 3 years before most of Admiralty Island became a national monument. The federal legislation allowed for the development of a mine in the event the deposit proved up. The mine was closed for 6 years in the 1990s because of low mineral prices. Hecla was part owner with Kennecott in those days. In 2008, Hecla bought out its partner for $750 million. These numbers had the attention of the Sitka Chamber audience. In June, the Assembly postponed consideration of spending $72,000 on a geotechnical survey along Green Lake Road. Satry is also a professional geologist. He explained that although Greens Creek was on the next island, geologically it was a world apart. He said that the ore deposit was formed hundreds of millions of years ago as black sulfide-rich gases billowed from an ancient seabed.
Luckily, at that same time that those sulfides were being ejected from these vents, there was some real muddy carbonate-rich sediments were being deposited right on top of that, and they preserved that ore body over the years. And that formed many thousands of miles away from us, and just like the rest of Southeast Alaska, through plate tectonics, was slammed up against the North American Craton, and it's where it's at today.
Ironically, mining was one of Sitka's largest industries following the Russian transfer in the 19th century, with 40% of residents involved in the search for gold, according to a research paper by Matt Hunter, who currently holds a seat on Sitka's assembly. None of the dozens of mines or claims in the area ever repaid their investment. Nevertheless, Sitka Economic Development Director Gary White, who attended the presentation, asked Satry where he thought mineral prices were headed. Satry responded, as he has likely many times before, "If I knew that, I wouldn't have to work in a mine." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Bethel was a hot spot for celebrities last week. A handful showed up at the Bethel Regional High School. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
In the mix was the CEO of Taco Bell, Greg Creed, rapper Kendrick Lamar, NBA basketball star James Harden, and MTV personality Sway Calloway. Calloway gave some introductions at the high school.
Give it up for Kendrick! So Dallas, we got one more, right? All the way from the Houston Rockets, one of the best the NBA has today. Give it up for the one, the only, James Harden!
The visit was kept secret for the most part, but there was a buzz floating around among students.
I'm Ethan Forbes.
I'm Lily Reichard. The CEO of Taco Bell is coming to our school.
Yeah, what Lily said, like, we won the competition.
The competition was nationwide, called the Future Forward Challenge, put on by the organization Get Schooled. Students had to fulfill several different tasks, like discussions with college experts, educational games, and seniors filling out their college financial aid forms. The competition ran January through March of last year, and the visitors are part of the students' prize.
I think the whole school is just totally excited. I mean, stuff like this doesn't happen here that often, so...
Super exciting. It's kind of too exciting for words. Like, really, like, I don't know what to say about it. It's just like, I'm just soaking it in, like, embracing the moment with the CEO of Taco Bell. Yeah, like, it's not even real.
Taco Bell's CEO, Greg Creed, is from Australia. He says that teenagers have always been a neglected group, but people need to focus on them because they're the future.
What I want the kids to get out of this is that they can have a dream, a big dream, and that you can actually make your big dream come to life.
Okay, now open your mind up and listen to me, Kendrick.
Rapper Kendrick Lamar held a workshop in a small classroom full of students.
Professor Lamar, I came all the way here, far from my home. Cadillac Bone. I'm freestyling with Bethel, let's get it on.
I didn't have too much leadership when I was in high school. You know, I was always trying to find and figure out, you know, what I want to do with myself. So if they can get it a little bit earlier, you know, being 16, 15 years old, they have a better chance in life, you know, than a lot of folks that don't have that leadership.
NBA basketball player James Harden says he came to Bethel to support the students for all their hard work. His message to them was not to give up.
Just to continue to, you know, go for your dreams, you know, whatever it is. You know, it's definitely probably not going to be easy, but whatever your dreams is, chase them and do whatever it takes to get them.
BRHS principal Janelle Vanas helped keep the visit under wraps. She called the experience for the students fabulous.
We do it every day, but we can't say it like they can say it, so it's really immeasurable.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
A key figure in Valdi's history has died. John Kelsey wore many hats, but is best known for building Valdi's to what it is today. He's most remembered for bringing economic development to the city in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Kelsey led the way in rebuilding Valdi's after it was destroyed by the 1964 Good Friday earthquake. KCHU's Tony Gorman has this remembrance.
In 2007, the city of Valdi's named its municipal dock the John Thomas Kelsey Municipal Dock. Every year, vessels connect Valdi's to the rest of the state and the world through commerce every time they tie up there. The dock's namesake also did that during his time in Valdi's. Kelsey passed away last week. When Valdi's Mayor Pro Temp Dorothy Moore heard the news, she knew the city had lost a good leader.
He was involved in a lot of things, in turning the city around in the 50s and 60s and 70s. and on into the 80s and 90s.
A fourth-generation Alaskan, he was born in Valdez in 1920. He graduated high school in a class of 10 in 1938. Kelsey went on to earn a Bachelor's of Engineering degree from Stanford University. He also attended graduate school at Columbia University, along with U.S. Navy Officer Candidate School and Anti-Submarine School, and earned the rank of lieutenant. During the war, he was assigned to the Pacific Theater. Those were the only few times in his life that he stepped foot outside of Valdez. After the war, Kelsey returned home to help his father and brother run the Valdez Dock Company. The Kelseys owned the business from 1940 to 1989. Kelsey served as fire chief, city councilman, and mayor of Valdez along the way. Tom Gilson is a longtime resident of Valdez. His family and the Kelseys have known each other for a very long time. Gilson says Kelsey always wanted to do what was best for Valdez.
John used to always say, talking about the good old days, he says, you know, the good old days weren't all that good. And they weren't. Everybody was in the same boat. We had a lot of ups and downs in Old Town. And guys like John ended up trying to make those the good old days a whole lot better, I guess the future a whole lot better.
Gilson says Kelsey always spoke up for Valdez long before lobbyists entered the political world.
They would ask John Kelsey to go intercede for the city down in Juneau, and to my recollection, he always went. He's never said no to the people of Valdez.
Kelsey led a group to buy the bankrupt Brady apartment complex in 1956. It became Harborview Nursing Home and eventually Harborview Memorial Hospital. Harborview was just one of Kelsey's many accomplishments after the earthquake destroyed the old Valdez and the city had to rebuild from the ground up in a new location. Perhaps the biggest one was bringing the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System's terminal to Valdez. Gilson remembers when his uncle George, who was mayor at the time, and Kelsey made their pitch by going up to the Captain Cook Hotel in Anchorage and spreading maps of Valdez across the floor in front of the oil executives who were staying there at the time.
I don't know if they were looking at Valdez that seriously until John and George showed up and showed that Valdez was a deep water port. It was ice free, and you know, this is one of the reasons why Valdez is where it is today, if it wasn't for guys like that.
Kelsey was 93 when he died. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Tony Gorman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Angela Denning-Barnes in Bethel, and Tony Gorman in Valdez. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
The Salmon Project. In Alaska, salmon are food, annual traditions, and a source of jobs, businesses, and community. Information on caring for salmon habitat or your weekend catch, plus salmon love stories at salmonlove.com. The Federal Subsistence Board is seeking ideas to improve the rural determination process. Only Alaska residents living in rural areas or communities are eligible to harvest fish and wildlife resources on federal public lands under federal subsistence regulations. The deadline to submit your ideas is November the 1st. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.